Well, first, we're starting with a few Wikipedia facts. The most popular entries in the Japanese version of the free, collaboratively authored encyclopedia are about pop culture. In Russia, they most favour articles about geography, we're told, and sex is popular in all territories, apparently, but with the exception of France and Spain, for some reason. So how do I know all this? Well, these and other insights came about when Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales gave the keynote address at the annual meeting and exhibition of the Symbian smartphone community in London last week. A former options trader, Jimmy Wales founded Wikipedia in 2001, and it's gone on to become one of the most widely visited websites on the planet, propelling Wales to something approaching rock star status both inside and outside the tech world. Well, after his address to the London meeting, I managed to catch up with Jimmy, and we began by discussing his venture related to Wikipedia. This is called Wikia.
So most people are familiar with Wikipedia, and Wikia is the rest of the library. So it's all of the other works that people might create, from humor sites, political activism sites, pop culture sites. And they aren't all neutral like Wikipedia. They're more fun, less sort of serious. And well, everybody loves Wikipedia because it's very serious, but it's more of a fun side of things.
You can get things like song lyrics for bands. In fact, I was just using it the other day. I just typed in, I think, into a search engine the name of a band and some song I was looking up. And I think that went to like a Wikia page or a site or whatever.
Yeah, we have the lyrics wiki, and the community comes together to write the lyrics. And, of course, sometimes the lyrics are a little debatable, so there's some interesting discussions that go on because people aren't quite sure. And sometimes the band sings different variants, and they'll document all of those. It's kind of an innovative site in the sense that we have a contract with Gracenote for licensing because these are copyrighted materials. And so figuring out how do you let a community work with copyrighted material was a bit of a challenge, but we got that sorted.
And there's a green Wikia as well, I gather. I think you were talking about that.
Yes, we have the Wikia Green site, and this is basically where people who are interested in issues around sustainable living are coming together. And it's really a consumer-focused site, so it's not a debate site. It's really about, you know, I think for a lot of people you think, gee, I want to reduce my carbon impact, but I don't want to be foolish about it. I want to do it in an efficient way. Why should I spend an extra £1,000 on something that doesn't do much good if I could do something smaller? And so it's where people can come together and really put forward those kinds of ideas and fact check each other and really come up with some solutions that will be more convenient for people.
And of course, you're very keen on rolling Wikipedia out even further around the world, with an emphasis, I've been reading, on the developing world especially.
Yeah, the developing world is something that's becoming more and more of a primary interest for us, because when we look at the vision I have for Wikipedia, which is a free encyclopedia for everyone in their own language, we're succeeding. We're accomplishing that goal. With all of the difficulties and controversies around Wikipedia, we feel pretty good. We're achieving that goal in a lot of languages, all of the European languages, for example. But we still have a long way to go. So, for example, in the languages of India, we're seeing in some of them 10% monthly growth, which is really exciting, but they're still quite small. In terms of the languages of Africa, though, we have a very few languages that have any substantial size at all. Swahili is around 10,000 entries now, but that's quite tiny compared to what we think of as a really successful project with 200,000 entries. So that's become more of a focus of our work, is to think about how do we do more outreach in those areas? How do we get people who have a home language and they're educated in English or French, and how can we encourage them to participate in their home language to help people who aren't reading English or French? And so those are some of the issues that we're really interested in.
Yeah, because I was just wondering what your audience is, or numbers of contributors to Wikipedia are from Africa, maybe in, you know, Francophone Africa in French or in the English language. I mean, do you have figures on that off the top of your head, or is that some kind of idea?
We do have figures which are basically so low as to be difficult to even measure. The core reason for that is that the number of people online in Africa is quite small. Even in developed areas of Africa, for example, in South Africa, the price of broadband internet there is quite exorbitant for a number of reasons. Monopoly telecom, all the classic problems that lots of places have. Those issues are starting to be improved. Just recently, they dropped a new line, substantially increasing the bandwidth in Western Africa. That trickles down eventually to internet cafes who can then, instead of paying so much for an internet connection, they can get a better internet connection, or they can instead spend the money on more computers, more seats, more availability. So these things are changing quickly in Africa. And in the next 5 to 10 years, particularly through mobile, people are going to have more and more access to the internet in these places. And I think it's really important for Wikipedia, but I also think it's really important for the world. I think we're about to experience some really interesting cultural implications. We look at the English language news media, even the English language news media that is more globally focused, like the BBC or the BBC World Service in particular, there's still a certain focus, and we're not hearing from everybody in the world. We hear very unevenly from places around the world, and I think that's going to start to even out, and we're going to start getting cultural influences from places we know almost nothing about today, and I think that's going to be really fascinating.
Jimmy Wales there. Will it speak now to studio commentator Bill Thompson? And Bill, listening to that, lots of plans to go into lots of different countries for Wikipedia. But what about these territories that Jimmy has his eye on? Presumably they've got homegrown, or hopefully developing homegrown, knowledge bases of their own.
Well, very few of them actually will, I think, Gareth, partly because internet access is relatively new. And, of course, Jimmy Wales is a bit of a figurehead, but the Wikipedia movement is much, much larger than him, and he doesn't sort of drive it, he doesn't tell it what to do. The fact is that the people who've built Wikipedia want to share their knowledge and expertise, also want to share their software around the world. And as more countries go online and there's reasonable quality of internet access, people will pick up those structures and start to work with them. I think it's going to be really interesting, though, to see whether the cultural model behind Wikipedia, where anyone can contribute, but you do have a group of editors who can assert quite strong control over what happens, whether that makes its way into these other countries, or whether, in fact, we see Wikipedia itself have to change its internal culture to cope with these new cultures of contributors.
All right, well, thank you very much for that, Bill. More from you in a few moments, and more from Jimmy Wales next week. We're going to have part two of that interview with him on next week's programme. Moving on, though, Isaac Newton was one of the most notable to refer to the phrase dwarfs standing on the shoulders of giants. It was a way of discussing how science progresses by building on previous discoveries. Well, traditionally, scientists have collaborated with each other through the learned journals and at conferences. But added to that, these days, there are various online services that are selling themselves as resources for the scientific and indeed wider academic communities to pool data and to network and to share ideas. And with all that research held in one place, then there are opportunities to mine it for trends and patterns impossible to pick up when the dwarfs were standing on giant shoulders but without their laptops. Well, Mendeley is a so-called Science 2.0 service with a growing community, as I've been hearing from Victor Henning, one of the founders and director.
First of all, the idea is that pretty much every scientist already has a collection of research papers. And so Mendeley is supposed to take the work out of managing these papers. You can just drag and drop your collection of PDFs into the Mendeley software, and it'll automatically extract all the bibliographic data, that is the author, title, volume, journal, issue, all of the stuff that you'd usually have to type in manually. So you'd already have your library of documents, which you could then search and annotate and share with others. But based on that, what Mendeley is designed to do is give you recommendations which complement your existing library. There's the automated discovery, I would say, but also you could go to the site and say, if you're doing digital studies, could be computer science, could be cultural studies, that you go to the page for the specific discipline and you can find the top 5 papers for that given week, for example.
So if I wanted to do these kinds of things manually, then I might have to go onto a search engine and dig it all out or call up a few colleagues on the phone. You're just saying, well, we can fix you up with like-minded scientists. And it's partly to do with keeping a check on work in progress. So as I go about some scientific research, I can be putting results onto Mendeley as I'm going along. So the obvious concern as a competitive scientist would be, well, what's going to happen with my data? I don't want my opponents in that particular field getting their hands on it.
Mm. We've designed the system in a way that, by default, the data that you're working with remains private, so no one can basically trace a document to you. What we do is we anonymously aggregate statistics. So you basically can use Mendeley, the software, without contributing to these statistics, but then you lose out on the collaborative features.
And obviously, to make this all work, you need to get a critical mass, to use a scientific word, a critical mass of scientists involved. And isn't that the problem, that you're not talking about individuals like teenagers who might sign up to a music sharing or recommendation service? Here you're relying on entire labs, departments, scientists all over the world to sign up.
So this is our first year, and the biggest user bases that we have are in that order at MIT, Stanford, Harvard, Cambridge, and the University of Michigan, where we each already have a couple of hundred users, and it's all grown by word of mouth. We have roughly 70,000 users at the moment, and it's been growing exponentially this year at roughly 40% each month.
For a scientist, is it free to use?
It is. Basically, we do have a free software and also free features on the website, which are designed to allow everyone to participate freely and sharing and collaboration. However, we will be introducing additional premium features later this year, such as more storage space, more sharing features for labs.
And that's not a polite way of saying, well, we're going to invite you all in for free, and then after 6 months, we're going to ask you to start paying us however many dollars a month it is to stay on.
We've always said that whatever is free will remain free, so we don't believe in this kind of bait-and-switch thing.
So you have a way of making money out of all this, then?
Yeah, we've already had requests from labs who are using Mendeley to collaboratively share the documents and manage them. And there are some limitations that we've built into the system for the time being, such as when you create a shared collection to collaborate with others. At the moment, that's limited to 10 people, and each person has a storage and upload limit of 500 megabytes. And so many labs that are using Mendeley are already actually asking us if they can pay to lift these limits. And we've had requests from entire faculties who would like to sign up, or even universities who would like to sign up their complete faculty in order to get statistics about their university's output.
And these are competitive times, especially for startups. Let's be very pessimistic here. It's a business reality. It may not work out. What's going to happen to all this scientific data, all these very expensive scientific projects that rely on Mendeley if the worst happens and it goes offline?
You can always import and export your data, so we're relying on open formats. That's for the stuff that you have locally, I would say. However, in terms of the global data that we're aggregating, we are currently working on an API, which is designed to allow scientists and groups to extract data and work with it, thereby obviously making the platform more interesting to everyone, but also, I think, ensuring that if the worst comes to worst, then people can get data out that they would like to work with.
BBC.
Victor Henning there, here on Digital Planet, on air, online and podcasting from the BBC in London. I'm Gareth Mitchell, and still to come, we're talking do-it-yourself audio guides for galleries and museums on your smartphone. So, is the world of science undergoing something of a revolution thanks to collaborative tools like the one we've just been hearing about from Victor? Well, if it is, then it's a big deal for people like us who rely on the outcomes of science to develop the drugs that keep us alive, the insights that explain our universe, and the technologies that we'll all need to mitigate climate change. Well, one expert who's excited by the opportunities that the web offers for him and his peers is Cameron Nalan, Senior Scientist for Biomolecular Sciences at the UK. Science and Technology Facilities Council.
The power of so-called Web 2.0 tools is they allow people to share a huge range of objects. They might be pictures, they might be text, or just raw data as a scientist might produce. So using those tools to more effectively push those objects around to other scientists has got to be a good thing.
And let's look at what's in the new scientific toolkit then. And I know that one of the technologies you're interested in is Google's new Wave community and application. And Google Wave, for people who haven't heard of it, I suppose it's best described by Google itself as what email would look like if it were invented today.
I think Google Wave offers two specific things. I mean, what it looks like in the media is this cross of email and instant messaging, which is great fun. Where it really wins for science is that actually these documents or waves can be made automated, so we can connect up documents and ideas with each other. So a particular chemical compound, for instance, could be labelled and linked back to a database. And that lets us start to link up all the references to that single chemical compound and connect all of those together. but it can also do all this without necessarily requiring the user to do too much work.
Google Wave has the tools within it to link, as you say, keywords together and to get lots of people who are using similar scientific concepts to link up with each other. And I understand that bit. But Google Wave also includes these kind of robots as such, aren't they? And I assume they're not robots in a kind of R2-D2 context.
They're not far off that, perhaps, in as much as what makes Wave particularly appealing is that they can almost have a conversation with the user. What these robots can do is watch what you're typing and suggest that maybe perhaps you want to link this to this database or you want to link to this other web service and actually do that for you, almost as simply as a spell checker would offer you alternative spellings.
Now, the idea of an application that's going to make lots of suggestions, I'm afraid, has echoes in my mind of that really annoying paperclip that Microsoft has that will come up, and the scientific equivalent would be, oh, it looks like you're trying to analyse some mass spectrometry data here. You know, can we help you? And often you find this automated help more of a hindrance than a help. Are you more confident that these more intelligent tools are going to offer guidance, advice or assistance or whatever in a slightly more positive way for your scientists?
You're not the first person who's brought up the paperclip, it has to be said. There's a risk of that, certainly, and it's a question of how well we build these tools. One of the nice things about Wave, though, is that it will be able to monitor the kind of things that you want. So a classic example is if you're a chemist and you're marking things up, then you don't want to be offered links necessarily to a database for things like he or I, despite the fact that these are perfectly good chemical terms for helium and iodine. So it's entirely possible to store within the Wave a set of terms that are dynamically managed that you don't want marked up, or a record of the ones that you've chosen or not chosen, and to use those to make those offerings much better and much more useful to the person who's actually using it.
And I'd imagine that most people listening to this are not scientists, and they may be nodding away at their radio or their MP3 player thinking, well, that's all very good for them. What does it mean for us, this kind of collaboration? If this is kind of going through the scientific community, are there likely to be spin-offs for people outside science?
I think a lot of the problems scientists have are specific cases of the problems that the wider community has. For instance, if you wanted to look up which restaurants in your town were open on a Sunday night, now, this is not something that's easy to do in Google, but it's an example of what's called so-called semantic search. And those kind of searches aren't really possible because the web isn't geared up to give them to you because it's not connected up in this intelligent way. What we're talking about for science is to try and do a specific case of that connecting up. And hopefully that will spread out into the consumer web as well.
Cameron Nayland there. So, Bill Thompson, a couple of ways of making science hopefully a bit more collaborative online. I mean, the really big question here is, are we going to end up as a result with better science and therefore a better society?
Well, I don't know whether better science necessarily leads to a better society, certainly a different society. Mm. It is interesting to see how we live in an era now of technology-based science, where a lot of the research that's done relies absolutely on computers and on electronics and things like that. Now it looks like the scientists and the scientific community are embracing the social internet and all of those tools for collaboration and try to take things a bit further. And, of course, it is actually possible that what we'll see will actually be new ways of doing science emerge. And for possibly the first time in a generation, it will be able to say there actually is a new paradigm. The word paradigm is so abused by everybody, but this is actually what it's about, a new way of doing something. And it may well be that tools like Mendeley that we heard about, and even tools like Wave, allow that to happen and a whole new way of doing science comes out.
And there will be Thomas Kuhn followers nodding their heads at that, Bill. Thank you very much indeed. Well, finally, we have the latest twist on those audio guides that accompany many exhibitions and galleries, because now you can join a community around the attraction in question and, in fact, add a guide of your own based on your ideas or expertise. And you can do it through audio or text, and then you can share your guide with others via a website that then integrates with your phone. In France, the result is a collection of user-generated trails, or treks, as they're known, through places like the Louvre in Paris or indeed the Musée des Arts. Well, the service, called MuseTrek, is currently only on the iPhone, but they're soon to bring it out on other smartphones too. And our reporter in Paris, Sasha Gankin, went on a tour with Noémie Tassel. She's director of MuseTrek and one of its inventors.
So MuseTrek at the Art Decorative Museum is available on the iPhone device, and we wanted to make it easy to use. So when you arrive on the main screen, you have four different menus. One is by an object guide, so when you click on it, you find a list of the various objects that are part of the experiment. You also have another icon which enables you to go trekking. So when you click on this icon, you are proposed with a list of 16 treks to follow within the museum, and different thematics are available, such as nature, game, design, or artistic perspectives. So those treks can make you visit the museum in a new ways, telling you a story, bringing you back in time, or following different things than a traditional audio guide. Because the idea of MuseTrek is to create your own cultural profile and get used to have the application on your own iPhone for free. So on the internet, you can create your profile and you can yourself tour treks within the museum, write comments about those, and then once back home, you can start creating your own treks and proposing it to others.
So this is the software you can practically download from your website for free. And this software, this MuseTrek software, on more or less in the future on every smartphone, yeah? It's not necessarily iPod, it's going to be any other smartphone, isn't it?
We would like to develop it in that way. For now, it's just iPhone and iPod Touch because those are pretty user-friendly and you need to start somewhere. But of course, the idea is to broaden the experiment for Google, Android, for Blackberries, and even older phones.
Let's choose our visit for today.
For today, I suggest we could do something like a travel back in time machine, and we could finish by the nature perspective.
Okay, let's go.
So I'm clicking on my screen now and looking at a small resume of the treks. And it happens that I'm interested in that following time machine. I can orient myself on clicking with the map icons and direct myself to the object. It's right there. We are entering a room with a lot of statues from the Middle Age.
We're in front of the tapisserie, a big carpet called the woodcutter. This is the object of the 16th century. Yeah. What does our MuseTrek tell us?
They call me Jihan, and I'm going to tell you the story of a voyage. It all started on a hot summer afternoon in a forest in Brabant while I was helping my companions, the woodcutters, who were collecting fallen branches. At the hour when the sun is at its zenith, we drank fresh water from an earthenware pitcher suspended from a sling that kept us safe from beasts and blows.
So here we are arriving on the gallery displaying the object of the 20th century, where our MuseTrek back in times ends with the Bel Air objects. Bel Air is an object that recycles the air thanks to a plant inside the objects.
And this is one of the objects which was developed by Le Laboratoire in Paris, yeah?
Absolutely, in collaboration with the designer Mathieu Levaneur. And maybe we can listen to a track about it.
Mathieu immediately clambers down the lit steps with his prototype under an arm. Inside the plastic housing is the spider plant. And beneath the plant, a couple liters of slushing water. An electrical cord drags behind Mathieu over the stairs. He sets his precious object down at the base of the stairs and hurries to plug in the cord. The motor begins to hum. Mathieu sits down on the last step of the stairs and pulls out his cigarette box. "Oh, please," says David, sitting down next to Mathieu on the steps. "You're trying to filter the air, not dirty."
The ways are really open. You can follow a track created by, why not, journalists or students making comparison with classic art exposed here, with contemporary art, with pictures that they add on the website and that are displayed on the device. You can imagine people, some people recording poetry to tour a city, and during in the big steps of your travel, you just listen to a poetry. It can also be like we follow a story, an adventure, a quest, things like that. A lot of different options are open with MuseTrack. It's kind of a user-generated database such as Wikipedia or YouTube, but for cultural experiments and experience.
Noemi Tassel there with reporter Sasha Gankin. So finally, Bill, listening to that, is this whole idea, is it a work of art as far as you're concerned?
It is very beautiful, and I think they are quite compelling experiences. But I also think that the existence of MuseTrack and other services, which will no doubt grow up that are very similar, shows just how much the barriers have been brought down in cultural institutions, that the curators of the Louvre and other galleries now don't have the control over what we say and think about the artifacts they're storing. So it's another example of how the network is breaking down barriers and boundaries, and I think that's bound to continue.
Great. Well, thank you for that, Bill. We've had some culture today and indeed some philosophy of science. You only get that on Digital Planet. We will have more for you next week with more actually from Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales. But until then, from me, Gareth Mitchell, and producer Colin Grant, thanks very much for listening and goodbye.
BBC.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from the BBC. Digital Planet is one of a host of programmes from BBC Science. So, if you like this, then why not listen to our weekly news roundup of developments in Science in Action, and also Discovery, our science documentary.